glance back at me. I sat upright, staring, and the humour abruptly left his face. He turned and strode off, shoulders stiff as wood. In spite of hunger, thirst, and general discomfort, I actually felt a sense of profound, if momentary, relief. If I wasn't strictly speaking alone, I was at least unobserved, and even this modicum of privacy was balm. I was a good 20 yards from the firing, out of sight of all the men. I sagged against the tree trunk, the muscles of face and body giving way all at once, and a shiver seized me, though it wasn't cold. Soon. Surely Jamie would find me soon. Unless... I pushed the dubious thought aside, as though it were a venomous scorpion. Likewise, any thought of what had happened to Marsali, or might happen if and when... No, when he did find us. I didn't know how he'd manage, but he would. He just would. The sun was nearly down. Shadows were pooling under the trees and the light faded slowly from the air, making colours fugitive and solid objects lose their depth. There was rushing water somewhere nearby, and the calling of the occasional bird in the distant trees. These began to fall silent as the evening cooled, replaced by the rising chirp of crickets near at hand. My eye caught the flicker of movement, and I saw a rabbit, grey as the dusk, sitting up on its hind legs under a bush, a few feet distant, nose twitching. The sheer normalcy of it all made my eyes sting. I blinked away the tears, and the rabbit was gone. The sight of it had restored my nerve a little. I essayed a few experiments to see the limits of my present bondage. My legs were free. That was good. I could rise up into a sort of ungainly squat and duck waddle round the tree. Even better, I would be able to relieve myself in privacy on the far side. I could not, however, rise entirely to my feet, nor could I reach the knot of the line that circled the tree trunk. The rope either slid or caught on the bark, but in either case, the knot remained frustratingly on the opposite side of the trunk, which had to measure nearly 3 feet in diameter. I had about 2 feet of line between the trunk and the noose about my neck, enough to allow me to lie down or to turn from side to side. Hodgepyle was rather obviously well acquainted with convenient methods of restraining captives. I thought of the O'Briens' homestead and the two bodies there. The two elder children missing. A small shudder passed over me again. Where were they? Sold to one of the Indian tribes as slaves? Taken to a sailor's brothel in one of the coastal towns? Or onto a ship to be pressed into use on the sugar plantations of the Indies? I was under no illusions that any of these picturesquely unpleasant fates lay in store for me. I was much too old, much too obstreperous, and much too notorious. No, the only value I held for Hodgepyle was my knowledge of the whiskey cache. Once he got within sniffing distance of that, he would slit my throat without a moment's compunction. The smell of roasting meat floated through the air, flooding my mouth with fresh saliva. A welcome relief, in spite of the growling of my stomach, since the gag dried my mouth unpleasantly. A tiny jolt of panic tensed my muscles. I didn't want to think about the gag, or the ropes around my wrists and neck. It would be too easy to succumb to the panic of confinement and exhaust myself in futile struggle. I had to preserve my strength. I didn't know when or how I would need it, but need it I surely would. Soon, I prayed. Let it be soon. The men had settled to their supper, the contentions of the day sunk in appetite. They were far enough away that I couldn't hear the particulars of their conversation, but only the stray word or phrase borne on the evening breeze. I turned my head to let the breeze smooth the hair from my face, and found that I could see a long, narrow swath of sky above the distant gorge, gone a deep, unearthly blue, as though the fragile layer of atmosphere that covered the earth grew thinner still, and the darkness of space beyond shone through. The stars began to prick out, one by one, and I managed to lose myself in watching, counting them as they appeared, one by one by one, touching them as I might the beads of a rosary, and saying to myself such astronomical names as I knew, comforting in their sound, even though I had no idea whether such names bore any relation to the celestial bodies I saw. Alpha Centauri, Deneb, Sirius, Betelgeuse, the Pleiades, Orion. I succeeded in soothing myself to the extent that I dozed off, only to rouse some time later to find it now full dark. The light of the fire sent a flickering glow through the underbrush, painting my feet, which lay in an open spot with rosy shadows. I stirred and stretched myself as well as I could, trying to relieve the stiffness in my back, and wondered whether Hodgepile thought himself safe now to be allowing such a large fire. A loud groan came to me on the wind. Lionel Brown. I grimaced, but there was nothing I could do for him in my present condition. I heard shuffling and a murmur of voices. Someone was attending to him. "Hot as a pistol," one voice said, sounding only mildly concerned. "Fetch the woman." "No," said a definite voice. "Hodgepile." I sighed. "Water. No help for that." I was listening so intently, in hopes of hearing what was happening by the fire, that it was some time before I became aware of noises in the brush nearby. Not animals. Only bears would make that much noise, and bears didn't giggle. The giggling was subdued, not only muffled, but repeatedly interrupted. There was whispering, too, though I couldn't make out most of the words. The overall atmosphere was so much one of excited juvenile conspiracy, though, that I knew it must be some of the younger members of the gang. "Go on, then," I caught, spoken in a vehement tone, and accompanied by a crashing noise, indicating that someone had been pushed into a tree. Another crash, indicating retaliation. More rustling. Whisper, whisper, snigger, snort. I sat upright, wondering what in God's name they were up to. Then I heard, "Her legs aren't tied." And my heart gave a small jump. "But what if she..." Mumble, mumble. "Won't matter, she can't scream." That came through very clearly, and I jerked my feet back to scramble up, only to be brought up short by the noose around my neck. It felt like an iron bar across my windpipe, and I fell back, seeing blood-red blotches at the corners of my eyes. I shook my head and gulped air, trying to shake off the dizziness, adrenaline racing through my blood. I felt a hand on my ankle and kicked out sharply. "Hey!" he said out loud, sounding surprised. He took his hand off my ankle and sat back a little. My vision was clearing. I could see him now, but the firelight was behind him. It was one of the young lads, but no more than a faceless, hunched silhouette in front of me. "Shh," he said, and giggled nervously, reaching out a hand toward me. I made a deep growling noise behind my gag, and he stopped, frozen in mid-reach. There was a rustling in the brush behind him. This seemed to remind him that his friend, or friends, were watching, and he reached out with renewed resolution, patting me on the thigh. "Don't you worry, ma'am," he whispered, duck walking closer on his heels. "I don't mean you no harm." I snorted and he hesitated again, but then another rustle from the bush seemed to stiffen his resolve, and he grasped me by the shoulders, trying to make me lie down. I struggled hard, kicking and kneeing at him, and he lost his grip, lost his balance, and fell on his backside. A muffled explosion of sniggering from the bush brought him up on his feet like a jack-in-the-box. He reached down with decision, seized my ankles, and yanked, jerking me flat. Then he flung himself on top of me, pinning me with his weight. "Hush," he said urgently into my ear. His hands were grappling for my throat, and I squirmed and thrashed under his weight, trying to buck him off. His hands closed tight on my neck, though, and I stopped, my vision going black and bloody once again.
"Hush now," he said more quietly. "You just hush, ma'am, all right?"
I was making small choking noises, which he must have taken for assent, for his grip slackened.
"I ain't gonna hurt you, ma'am, I really ain't," he whispered, trying to hold me down with one hand while fumbling about between us with the other. "Would you just be still? Please?"
I wouldn't, and he finally put a forearm across my throat and leaned on it. Not hard enough to make me black out again, but hard enough to take some of the fight out of me. He was thin and wiry, but very strong, and by dint of simple determination succeeded in pushing up my shift and wedging his knee between my thighs. He was breathing nearly as hard as I was, and I could smell the goaty reek of his excitement. His hands had left my throat and were feverishly grasping at my breasts, in a manner that made it reasonably clear that the only other breast he'd ever touched was likely his mother's.
"Hush now. Don't you be scared, ma'am. It's all right. I ain't... Oh. Oh, my. I... Oh. Oh!"
His hand was poking about between my thighs, then left off momentarily as he raised himself briefly and wriggled down his breeches. He collapsed heavily on top of me, hips pumping frantically as he thrust madly away, making no contact save that of friction, as he very obviously had no idea of the way in which female anatomy was constructed. I lay still, astonished into immobility, then felt a warm pulse of liquid under my thighs as he lost himself in panting ecstasy. All the wiry tension went out of him in a rush, and he subsided on my chest like a limp balloon. I could feel his young heart pounding like a steam hammer, and his temple was pressed against my cheek, damp with sweat. I found the intimacy of this contact quite as objectionable as the softening presence wedged between my thighs, and rolled abruptly to the side, dumping him off. He came to life suddenly, and scrambled to his knees, yanking at his drooping breeches. He swayed to and fro for a moment, then dropped to his hands and knees, and crawled up close beside me.
"I'm really sorry, ma'am," he whispered.
I made no move, and after a moment he reached out a tentative hand and patted me gently on the shoulder.
"I'm real sorry," he repeated, still whispering,
and then was gone, leaving me lying on my back in a puddle, wondering whether such an incompetent assault could legitimately be termed rape. Distant rustling in the bushes, accompanied by muffled whoops of young male delight, decided me firmly that it could. Christ, the rest of the obnoxious little beasts would be at me in no time. Panicked, I sat up, mindful of the noose. The glow from the fire was irregular and flickering, barely enough to make out the trunks of trees and the pale layer of needles and leaf mould on the ground. Enough to see the protrusions of granite boulders through the leaf layer, and the occasional hump of a fallen twig. Not that the lack of potential weapons mattered, given that my hands were still firmly tied. The weight of the young assailant had made things worse. The knots had pulled tighter during my struggles, and my hands throbbed with lack of circulation. My fingers were beginning to go numb at the tips. Bloody hell, was I about to lose several fingers to gangrene as a result of this absurdity? For an instant, I contemplated the wisdom of behaving compliantly with the next horrible little boy, in hopes that he would remove the gag. If he would, I could at least beg him to loosen the ropes, and then scream for help, in hopes that Tebby would come and stop further assault, out of fear of my eventual supernatural revenge. Here he came, a stealthy rustling in the bushes. I gritted my teeth on the gag and looked up, but the shadowy form in front of me wasn't one of the young boys. The only thought that came to mind when I realized who the new visitor was Jamie Fraser, you bastard! Where are you?
I froze, as though not moving might somehow render me invisible. The man moved in front of me, squatting down so as to look into my face.
Not laughing so much now, are you?
He said conversationally. It was Bobble, the erstwhile thief-taker.
You and your husband thought it was damn funny, didn't you, what them German women did to me? And then Mr. Fraser telling me as they meant to make sausage meat of me. And him with a face like a Christian reading the Bible. Thought that was funny too, didn't you?
To be perfectly honest, it had been funny. He was quite correct, though. I wasn't laughing now. He drew back his arm and slapped me. The blow made my eyes water, but the fire lit him from the side. I could still see the smile on his pudgy face. A cold qualm ran through me, making me shudder. He saw that, and the smile broadened. His canine teeth were short and blunt, so the incisors stood out by contrast, long and yellowed, rodent-like.
"Reckon you'll think this is even funnier," he said, rising to his feet and reaching for his flies. "Hope Hodge don't kill you right away, so you get to tell your husband about it. Bet you he'll enjoy the joke. Man with a sense of humour like he's got."
The boy's semen was still damp and sticky on my thighs. I jerked back by reflex, trying to scramble to my feet, but was brought up short by the noose round my neck. My vision went dark for an instant as the rope tightened on my carotids, then cleared, and I found Bobble's face inches from mine, his breath hot on my skin. He seized my chin in his hand and rubbed his face over mine, biting at my lips and rasping the stubble of his beard hard across my cheeks. Then he drew back, leaving my face wet with his saliva, pushed me flat, and climbed on top of me. I could feel the violence in him pulsing like an exposed heart, thin-walled and ready to burst. I knew I couldn't escape or prevent him, knew he would hurt me given the slightest excuse. The only thing to do was be still and endure him. I couldn't. I heaved under him and rolled to the side, bringing up my knee as he pushed my shift aside. It hit him a glancing blow in the thigh, and he drew back his fist by reflex and punched me in the face, sharp and quick. Red-black pain bloomed suddenly from the centre of my face, filled my head, and I went blind, shocked into momentary immobility. "You utter fool," I thought with total clarity. "Now he'll kill you." The second blow struck my cheek and snapped my head to the side. Perhaps I moved again in blind resistance. Perhaps I didn't. Suddenly he was kneeling astride me, punching and slapping, blows dull and heavy as the thump of ocean waves on sand, too remote as yet for pain. I twisted, curling, bringing up my shoulder and trying to shield my face against the ground, and then his weight was gone. He was standing. He was kicking me and cursing, panting and half-sobbing as his boot thudded into sides and back and thighs and buttocks. I panted in short gasps, trying to breathe. My body jerked and quivered with each blow, skidding on the leaf-strewn ground, and I clung to the sense of the ground below me, trying so hard to sink down, be swallowed by the earth. Then it stopped. I could hear him panting, trying to speak.
Damn! God damn! Oh, God damn! Frigging bitch!
I lay inert, trying to disappear into the darkness that enveloped me, knowing that he was going to kick me in the head. I could feel my teeth shatter, the fragile bones of my skull splinter and collapse into the wet, soft pulp of my brain, and I trembled, clenching my teeth in futile resistance against the impact. It would sound like a melon being smashed, dull, sticky hollow. Would I hear it? It didn't come. There was another sound, a fast, hard rustling that made no sense. A faintly meaty sound, flesh on flesh in a soft, smacking rhythm. And then he gave a groan, and warm gouts of fluid fell wet on my face and shoulders, splattering on bare skin where the cloth of my shift had torn away. I was frozen. Somewhere in the back of my mind, the detached observer wondered aloud whether this was, in fact, the single most disgusting thing I had ever encountered. Well, no, it wasn't. Some of the things I had seen at L'Hôpital des Anges, to say nothing of Father Alexandre's death, or the Beardsley's attic, the field hospital at Amiens. Heavens, no! This wasn't even close. I lay rigid, eyes shut, recalling various nasty experiences of my past, and wishing I were, in fact, in attendance at one of those events, instead of here. He leaned over, seized my hair, and banged my head several times against the tree, wheezing as he did so.
"Show you,"
he muttered. Then dropped his hand, and I heard shuffling noises as he staggered away. When I finally opened my eyes again, I was alone. I remained alone, a small mercy. Bobble's violent attack seemed to have frightened away the boys. I rolled onto my side and lay still, breathing. I felt very tired and utterly forlorn. "Jamie," I thought, "where are you?" I wasn't afraid of what might happen next. I couldn't see any further than the moment I was in. A single breath, a single heartbeat. I didn't think and wouldn't feel. Not yet. I just lay still and breathed. Very slowly I began to notice small things. A fragment of bark caught in my hair, scratchy on my cheek. The give of the thick dead leaves beneath me, cradling my body. The sense of effort as my chest lifted. Increasing effort. A tiny nerve began to twitch near one eye. I realized quite suddenly that with the gag in my mouth and my nasal tissues being rapidly congested by blood and swelling, I was in some actual danger of suffocation. I twisted as far onto my side as I could get without strangling, and rubbed my face first against the ground, then, with increasing desperation, dug my heels into the ground and wriggled upward, scraping my face hard against the bark of the tree, trying without success to loosen or dislodge the gag. The bark rasped lip and cheek, but the kerchief tied round my head was so tight that it cut hard into the corners of my mouth, forcing it open so that saliva leaked constantly into the wad of fabric in my mouth. I gagged at the tickle of sodden cloth in my throat and felt vomit burn at the back of my nose. "You aren't, you aren't, you aren't, you aren't, you aren't going to vomit." I dragged air bubbling through my bloody nose, tasted thick copper as it slimed down my throat, gagged harder, doubled up, and saw white light at the edge of vision as the noose went tight around my throat. I fell back, my head hitting hard against the tree. I hardly noticed. The noose loosened again, thank God, and I managed one, two, three precious breaths of blood-clogged air. My nose was puffed from cheekbone to cheekbone and swelling fast. I clenched my teeth on the gag and blew outward through my nose, trying to clear it, if only for a moment. Blood tinged with bile sprayed warm across my cheek and splattered on my chest, and I sucked air fast, getting a bit. Blow, inhale, blow, inhale, blow. But my nasal passages were almost swollen shut by now, and I nearly sobbed in panic and frustration as no air came. "Christ, don't cry. You're dead if you cry. For God's sake, don't cry." Blow. Blow. I snorted with the last reserve of stale air in my lungs and got a hair of clearance, enough to fill them once more. I held my breath, trying to stay conscious long enough to discover a way to breathe. There had to be a way to breathe. I would not let a wretch like Harley Bobble kill me by simple inadvertence. That wasn't right. It couldn't be.
I pressed myself, half-sitting, up against the tree to ease the strain on the noose around my neck as much as possible, and let my head fall forward so that the blood from my nose ran down, dripping. That helped a little. Not for long, though. My eyelids began to feel tight. My nose was definitely broken, and the flesh all round the upper part of my face was puffing now, swelling with the blood and lymph of capillary trauma, squeezing my eyes shut, further constricting my thread of air. I bit the gag in an agony of frustration, then, seized by desperation, began to chew at it, grinding the fabric between my teeth, trying to smash it down, compress it, shift it somehow inside my mouth. I bit the inside of my cheek and felt the pain, but didn't mind. It wasn't important. Nothing mattered but breath. Oh, God, I couldn't breathe. Please help me breathe. Please. I bit my tongue, gasped in pain, and realized that I had succeeded in thrusting my tongue past the gag, reaching the tip of it to the corner of my mouth. By poking as hard as I could with my tongue tip, I had made a tiny channel of air. No more than a wisp of oxygen could ooze through it. But it was air, and that was all that mattered. I had my head canted painfully to one side, forehead pressed against the tree, but was afraid to move at all for fear of losing my slender lifeline of air, if the gag should shift when I moved my head. I sat still, hands clenched, drawing long, gurgling, horribly shallow breaths, and wondering how long I could stay this way. The muscles of my neck were already quivering from strain. My hands were throbbing again. They hadn't ever stopped, I supposed, but I hadn't had attention to spare for them. Now I did, and momentarily welcomed the shooting pains that outlined each nail with liquid fire, for distraction from the deadly stiffness spreading down my neck and through my shoulder. The muscles of my neck jumped and spasmed. I gasped, lost my air, and arched my body bow-like, fingers dug into the binding ropes as I fought to get it back. A hand came down on my arm. I hadn't heard him approach. I turned blindly, butting at him with my head. I didn't care who he was or what he wanted, provided he would remove the gag. Rape seemed a perfectly reasonable exchange for survival, at least at the moment. I made desperate noises, whimpering, snorting, and spewing gouts of blood and snot as I shook my head violently, trying to indicate that I was choking. Given the level of sexual incompetence so far demonstrated, he might not even realize that I couldn't breathe, and simply proceed about his business, unaware that simple rape was becoming necrophilia. He was fumbling round my head. Thank God! Thank God! I held myself still with superhuman effort, head swimming as little bursts of fire went off inside my eyeballs. Then the strip of fabric came away, and I thrust the wad of cloth out of my mouth by reflex, instantly gagged, and threw up, whooping air and retching simultaneously. I hadn't eaten. No more than a thread of bile seared my throat and ran down my chin. I choked and swallowed and breathed, sucking air in huge, greedy, lung-bursting gulps. He was saying something, whispering urgently. I didn't care, couldn't listen. All I heard was the grateful wheeze of my own breathing and the thump of my heart. Finally, slowing from its frantic race to keep oxygen moving round my starved tissues, it pounded hard enough to shake my body. Then a word or two got through to me, and I lifted my head, staring at him.
What?
I said thickly. I coughed, shaking my head to try to clear it. It hurt very much.
What did you say?
He was visible only as a ragged, lion-haired silhouette, bony-shouldered in the faint glow from the fire.
I said, he whispered, leaning close, does the name Ringo Starr mean anything to you?
I was by this time well beyond shock. I merely wiped my split lip gingerly on my shoulder and said very calmly, yes. He had been holding his breath. I realized it only when I heard the sigh as he released it, and saw his shoulders slump.
"Oh, God," he said, half under his breath. "Oh, God."
He lunged forward suddenly and caught me against him in a hard embrace. I recoiled, choking as the noose round my neck tightened once again. But he didn't notice, absorbed in his own emotion.
"Oh, God," he said,
and buried his face in my shoulder, nearly sobbing.
"Oh, God, I knew you had to be. I knew it, but I couldn't believe it. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. I didn't think I'd ever find another one, not ever."
I said. I arched my back urgently.
"What? Oh, shit."
He let go and grabbed for the rope around my neck. He scrabbled hold of it and yanked the noose over my head, nearly tearing my ear off in the process, but I didn't mind.
"Shit. You okay?"
"Yes," I croaked.
"And tie me."
He sniffed, wiping his nose on his sleeve, and glanced back over his shoulder.
"I can't," he whispered. "The next guy who comes along will see." "The next guy?"
I screamed, as well as I could scream in a strangled whisper.
"What do you mean, the next?"
"Well, you know." It seemed suddenly to dawn on him that I might have objections to waiting tamely like a trussed turkey for the next would-be rapist in the lineup.
Well, never mind. Who are you?" "You know damn well who I am," I croaked furiously, shoving him with my bound hands. "I'm Claire Fraser."
"Who in bloody hell are you? What are you doing here? And if you want one more word out of me, you'll bloody well untie me this minute." He turned again to glance apprehensively over his shoulder, and it occurred to me vaguely that he was afraid of his so-called comrades.
So was I.
I could see his profile in silhouette. It was indeed the bushy-haired young Indian, the one I had thought might be a Tuscaroran.
Indian.
Some connection clicked into place, deep in the tangled synapses.
"Bloody hell,"
I said, and dabbed at a trickle of blood that ran from the raw corner of my mouth.
"Ottertooth. Tooth.
You're one of his."
"What?"
His head swung back to face me, eyes so wide the whites showed briefly.
"Who?"
"Oh, what in hell was his real name?"
"Robert.
Robert F... something." I was trembling with fury, terror, shock and exhaustion, groping through the muddled remnants of what used to be my mind. Wreck though I might be, I remembered Ottertooth all right. I had a sudden vivid memory of being alone in the dark, on a night like this, wet with rain and all alone, a long-buried skull cupped in my hands.
"Springer," he said,
and gripped my arm eagerly.
"Springer. Was that it? Robert Springer?"
I had just enough presence of mind to clamp my jaw, thrust out my chin, and hold up my bound hands in front of him. Not another word until he cut me loose.
"Shit,"
he muttered again, and with another hasty glance behind him, fumbled for his knife. He wasn't skillful with it. If I had needed any evidence that he wasn't a real Indian of the time. But he got my hands free without cutting me, and I doubled up with a groan, hands tucked under my armpits as the blood surged into them. They felt like balloons, filled and stretched to the point of bursting.
"When?"
he demanded, paying no attention to my distress.
"When did you come? Where did you find Bob? Where is he?"
1946, I said, squeezing my arms down tight on my throbbing hands. "The first time. 1968, the second. As for Mr. Springer..."
"The second?
Did you say the second time?" His voice rose in astonishment. He choked it off, looking guiltily back. But the sounds of the men dicing and arguing round the fire were more than loud enough to drown out a simple exclamation.
"Second time," he repeated more softly. "So you did it. You went back?"
I nodded, pressing my lips together and rocking back and forth a little. I thought my fingernails would pop off with each heartbeat.
"What about you?" I asked, though I was fairly sure that I already knew.
1968, he said, confirming it.
"What year did you turn up in?" I asked. "I mean, how long have you been here? Now, I mean."
"Oh, God."
He sat back on his heels, running a hand back through his long, tangled hair.
"I've been here 6 years, as near as I can tell."
"But you said second time.
If you made it home, why in hell did you come back?"
"Oh, wait. You didn't make it home. You went to another time, but not the one you came from. Where'd you start from?"
"Scotland, 1946.
And, no, I made it home," I said, not wanting to go into details. "My husband was here, though. I came back on purpose to be with him." A decision whose wisdom seemed presently in severe doubt.
"And speaking of my husband," I added, beginning to feel as though I might possess a few shreds of sanity after all, "I was not joking. He's coming. You don't want him to find you keeping me captive, I assure you. But if you..."
He disregarded this, leaning eagerly toward me.
"But that means you know how it works. You can steer."
"Something like that," I said, impatient. "I take it that you and your companions didn't know how to steer, as you put it." I massaged one hand with the other, gritting my teeth against the throb of blood. I could feel the furrows the rope had left in my flesh.
"We thought we did."
Bitterness tinged his voice. "Singing stones. Gemstones. That's what we used.
Raymond said..." "It didn't work, though."
"Or maybe... maybe it did." He was making deductions. I could hear the excitement rising again in his tone.
"You mean Bob Springer? Ottertooth, I mean. So he did make it. And if he made it, maybe the others did too. See, I thought they were all dead. I thought I was alone."
There was a catch in his voice, and despite the urgency of the situation and my annoyance at him, I felt a pang of sympathy. I knew very well what it felt like to be alone in that way, marooned in time. In a way, I hated to disillusion him, but there was no point in keeping the truth from him.
"Ottertooth is dead, I'm afraid." He suddenly stopped moving and sat very still. The faint glow of firelight through the trees outlined him. I could see his face. A few long hairs lifted in the breeze. They were the only thing that moved.
"How?" he said at last, in a small, choked voice.
"Killed by the Iroquois," I said. "The Mohawk." My mind was beginning, very slowly, to work again. 6 years ago, this man, whoever he was, had come. 1767, that would be. And yet Ottertooth, the man who had once been Robert Springer, had died more than a generation earlier. They'd started out together, but ended in different times.
"Shit," he said, though the obvious distress in his voice was mingled with something like awe. "That would have been a real bummer, especially for Bob. He, like, idolized those guys."
"Yes, I expect he was most put out about it," I replied rather dryly. My eyelids felt thick and heavy. It was an effort to force them open, but I could still see. I glanced at the fire glow, but couldn't see anything beyond the faint movement of shadows in the distance. If there actually was a lineup of men waiting for my services, at least they were tactfully keeping out of sight. I doubted it, and gave silent thanks that I wasn't 20 years younger. I might have been.
"I met some Iroquois. Christ, I went looking for them, if you can believe that. That was the whole point, see? To find the Iroquois tribes and get them to..."
"Yes. I know what you had in mind," I interrupted.
"Look, this is not really the time or place for a long discussion. I think that..." "Those Iroquois are some nasty tumblers, I tell you, man," he said, jabbing me in the chest with a finger for emphasis. "You wouldn't believe what they do to—" "I know."
"So is my husband."
I gave him a glare, which, judging from the way he flinched, was probably rendered highly effective by the state of my face.
"I hope so. It hurt a lot to do it."
"Now, what you want to do," I said, mustering as much authority into my voice as I could, "is to go back to the fire, wait for a bit, then leave casually, sneak around, and get two horses. I hear a stream down there." I waved briefly to the right. "I'll meet you there. Once we're safely away, I'll tell you everything I know." In fact, I probably couldn't tell him anything very helpful, but he didn't know that. I heard him swallow.
"I don't know," he said uncertainly, glancing round again.
"Hodge, he's kind of gnarly. He shot one guy a few days ago. Didn't even say anything. Just walked up to him, pulled his gun, and boom."
"What for?"
He shrugged, shaking his head. "I don't even know, man. Just boom, you know."
"I know," I assured him, holding on to temper and sanity by a thread.
"Look, let's not trouble with the horses, then. Let's just go."
I lurched awkwardly onto one knee, hoping I would be able to rise in a few moments, let alone walk. The big muscles in my thighs were knotted hard in the spots where Bobble had kicked me. Trying to stand made the muscles jump and quiver in spasms that effectively hamstrung me.
"Shit, not now."
In his agitation, the young man seized my arm and jerked me down beside him. I hit the ground hard on one hip and let out a cry of pain.
"You all right there, Donna?"
The voice came out of the darkness somewhere behind me. It was casual. Obviously, one of the men had merely stepped out of camp to relieve himself. But the effect on the young Indian was galvanizing. He flung himself full length upon me, banging my head on the ground and knocking all the breath out of me.
"Fine. Really. Great," he called to his companion, gasping in an exaggerated manner, evidently trying to sound like a man in the throes of half-completed lust. He sounded like someone dying of asthma, but I wasn't complaining. I couldn't. I'd been knocked on the head a few times and generally saw nothing but blackness as a result. This time I honestly did see coloured stars and lay limp and bemused, feeling as though I sat tranquilly some distance above my battered body. Then Donna laid a hand on my breast and I came instantly back to earth.
"Let go of me this instant," I hissed. "What do you think you're doing?"
"Hey, hey, nothing. Nothing, sorry," he assured me hastily.
He removed the hand, but didn't get off me. He squirmed a bit, and I realized that he was aroused by the contact, whether intended or not.
"Get off," I said in a furious whisper.
"Hey, I don't mean anything. I mean, I wouldn't hurt you or nothing. It's just, I haven't had a woman in—"
I grabbed a handful of his hair, lifted my head and bit his ear hard. He shrieked and rolled off me. The other man had gone back toward the fire.
At this, though, he turned and called back. "Christ, Donna, is she that good? I'll have to give her a try."
This got a laugh from the men by the fire, but luckily it died away, and they returned to their own concerns. I returned to mine, which was escape.
"You didn't have to do that," Donna whined in an undertone, holding his ear. "I wasn't going to do anything. Christ, you got nice tits, but you're, like, old enough to be my mother."
"Shut up," I said, pushing myself to a sitting position.
The effort made my head spin. Tiny coloured lights flickered like Christmas tree bulbs at the edge of my vision. In spite of this, some part of my mind was actively working again. He was at least partly right. We couldn't leave immediately. After drawing so much attention to himself, the others would be expecting him to come back within a few minutes. If he didn't, they'd start looking for him. And we needed more than a few minutes' start.
"'We can't go now,' he whispered, rubbing his ear reproachfully. "'They'll notice. "'Wait till they go to sleep. "'I'll come get you then.' "'I hesitated. "'I was in mortal danger every moment "'that I spent within reach of Hodgepile and his feral gang. "'If I had needed any convincing, "'the encounters of the last 2 hours had demonstrated that. "'This Donner needed to go back to the fire and show himself.' But I could steal away. Was it worth the risk that someone would come and find me gone before I'd got beyond pursuit? It would be more certain to wait until they slept. But did I dare wait that long? And then there was Donner himself. If he wanted to talk to me, I certainly wanted to talk to him. The chance of stumbling on another time traveller. Donner read my hesitation, but misunderstood it. "'You're not going without me.' "'He grabbed my wrist in sudden alarm, "'and before I could jerk away, "'had whipped a bit of the cut line around it. "'I fought and pulled away, hissing, "'to try to make him understand, "'but he was panicked at the thought "'that I might slip away without him, "'and wouldn't listen. "'Hampered by my injuries "'and unwilling to make enough noise to draw attention, "'I could only delay but not prevent "'his determined efforts to tie me up again. "'Okay.' He was sweating. A drop fell warm on my face as he leaned over me to check the bindings. At least he hadn't put the noose round my neck again, instead tethering me to the tree with a rope around my waist. "'I should have known what you are,' he murmured, intent on his job, "'even before you said Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ.' "'What the hell do you mean by that?' I snapped, squirming away from his hand. "'Don't bloody do that! I'll suffocate!' He was trying to put the cloth strip back in my mouth, but seemed to pick up the note of panic in my voice because he hesitated. "'Oh,' he said uncertainly. "'Well, I guess...' Once again he looked over his shoulder, but then made up his mind and dropped the gag on the ground. "'Okay, but you be quiet, all right? What I meant... "'You don't act afraid of men. "'Most of the women from now do. "'You ought to act more afraid.' "'And with that parting shot, "'he rose and brushed dead leaves from his clothes "'before heading back to the fire. "'There comes a point when the body has simply had enough. "'It snatches at sleep, no matter what menace the future may hold. "'I'd seen that happen.' The Jacobite soldiers who slept in the ditches where they fell. The British pilots who slept in their planes while mechanics fueled them, only to leap to full alert again in time to take off. For that matter, women in long labour routinely sleep between contractions. In the same manner, I slept. That kind of sleep is neither deep nor peaceful, though. I came out of it with a hand across my mouth. The fourth man was neither incompetent nor brutal. He was large and soft-bodied, and he had loved his dead wife. I knew that, because he wept into my hair and called me by her name at the end. It was Martha. I came out of sleep again some time later, instantly, fully conscious, heart pounding. But it wasn't my heart. It was a drum. Sounds of startlement came from the direction of the fire, men rousing in alarm from sleep. Indians! Someone shouted, and the light broke and flared as someone kicked at the fire to scatter it. It wasn't an Indian drum. I sat up, listening hard. It was a drum with a sound like a beating heart, slow and rhythmic, then trip-hammer fast, like the frantic surge of a hunted beast. I could have told them that Indians never used drums as weapons. Celts did. It was the sound of a bowron. What next? I thought, a trifle hysterically. Bagpipes? It was Roger, certainly. Only he could make a drum talk like that. It was Roger. And Jamie was nearby. I scrambled to my feet, wanting, needing urgently to move.
I jerked at the rope around my waist in a frenzy of impatience, but I was going nowhere. Another drum began, slower, less skilled, but equally menacing. The sound seemed to move. It was moving, fading, coming back full force. A third drum began, and now the thumping seemed to come from everywhere, fast, slow, mocking. Someone fired a gun into the forest, panicked.
"Hold there!"
Hodgepile's voice came, loud and furious, but to no avail. There was a popcorn rattle of gunfire, nearly drowned by the sound of the drums. I heard a snick near my head, and a cluster of needles brushed past me as it fell. It dawned on me that standing upright while guns were blindly fired all round me was a dangerous strategy, and I promptly fell flat, burrowing into the dead needles, trying to keep the trunk of the tree betwixt me and the main body of men. The drums were weaving, now closer, now farther, the sound unnerving even to one who knew what it was. They were circling the camp, or so it seemed. Should I call out if they came near enough? I was saved from the agony of decision. The men were making so much noise round the camp fire that I couldn't have been heard if I'd screamed myself hoarse. They were calling out in alarm, shouting questions, bellowing orders, which apparently went ignored, judging from the ongoing sounds of confusion. Someone blundered through the brush nearby, running from the drums. One, two more, the sound of gasping breath and crunching footsteps. Donna? The thought came to me suddenly, and I sat up, then fell flat again as another shot whistled past overhead. The drums stopped abruptly. Chaos reigned around the fire, though I could hear Hodgepile trying to get his men in order, yelling and threatening, nasal voice raised above the rest. Then the drums began again, much closer. They were drawing in, drawing together, somewhere out in the forest on my left, and the mocking tip-tap, tip-tap beating had changed. They were thundering now, no skill, just menace, coming closer. Guns fired wildly, close enough for me to see the muzzle flash and smell the smoke, thick and hot on the air. The faggots of the fire had been scattered, but still burned, making a muted glow through the trees.
"There they are! I see 'em!"
someone yelled from the fire, and there was another burst of musket fire toward the drums. Then the most unearthly howl rose out of the dark to my right. I'd heard Scott's scream going into battle before, but that particular Highland shriek made the hairs on my body prickle from tailbone to nape. Jamie. Despite my fears, I sat bolt upright and peered round my sheltering tree in time to see demons boil out of the wood. I knew them. Knew I knew them, but cowered back at the sight of them, blackened with soot and shrieking with the madness of hell, firelight red on the blades of knives and axes. The drums had stopped abruptly with a first scream, and now another set of howls broke out to the left, the drummers racing into the kill. I pressed myself flat back against the tree, heart chokingly huge in my throat, petrified for fear the blades would strike at any random movement in the shadows. Someone crashed toward me, blundering in the dark.
Donna?
I croaked his name, hoping to attract his attention, and the slight form turned toward me, hesitated, then spotted me and lunged. It wasn't Donna, but Hodgepile. He seized my arm, dragging me up, even as he slashed at the rope that bound me to the tree. He was panting hard with exertion or fear. I realized at once what he was about. He knew his chances of escape were slight. Having me to hostage was his only hope. But I was damned if I'd be his hostage. No more. I kicked him hard and caught him on the side of the knee. It didn't knock him over, but distracted him for a second. I charged him, head down, butted him square in the chest, and sent him flying. The impact hurt badly, and I staggered, eyes watering from the pain. He was up and at me again. I kicked, missed, fell heavily on my backside.
"Come on, damn you,"
he hissed, jerking hard at my bound hands. I ducked my head, pulled back, and yanked him down with me.
I rolled and scrabbled in the leaf mould, trying as hard as I could to wrap my legs around him, meaning to get a grip on his ribs and crush the life out of the filthy little worm. But he squirmed free and rolled atop me, punching at my head, trying to subdue me. He struck me in one ear, and I flinched, eyes shutting in reflex. Then the weight of him was suddenly gone, and I opened my eyes to see Jamie holding Hodgepile several inches off the ground. Hodgepile's spindly legs churned madly in a futile effort at escape, and I felt an insane desire to laugh. In fact, I must actually have laughed, for Jamie's head jerked round to look at me. I caught a glimpse of the whites of his eyes before he turned his attention to Hodgepile again. He was silhouetted against a faint glow from the embers. I saw him in profile for a second, then his body flexed with effort as he bent his head. He held Hodgepile close against his chest, one arm bent. I blinked. My eyes were swollen half shut, and I wasn't sure what he was doing. Then I heard a small grunt of effort and a strangled shriek from Hodgepile, and saw Jamie's bent elbow go sharply down. The dark curve of Hodgepile's head moved back. And back. I glimpsed the marionette's sharp nose and angled jaw, angled impossibly high. The heel of Jamie's hand wedged hard beneath it. There was a muffled pop that I felt in the pit of my stomach as Hodgepile's neck bones parted, and the marionette went limp. Jamie flung the puppet body down, reached for me, and pulled me to my feet. "You are alive. You are whole, Moniandown," he said urgently in Gaelic. He was groping, hands flying over me, trying at the same time to hold me upright. My knees seemed suddenly to have turned to water, and to locate the rope that bound my hands. I was crying and laughing, snuffing tears and blood, bumping at him with my bound hands, trying awkwardly to thrust them at him so that he could cut the rope. He quit grappling and clutched me so hard against him that I yelped in pain as my face was pressed against his plaid. He was saying something else, urgently, but I couldn't manage to translate it. Energy pulsed through him, hot and violent, like the current in a live wire, and I vaguely realized that he was still almost berserk. He had no English. "I'm all right," I gasped, and he let me go. The light flared up in the clearing beyond the trees. Someone had collected the scattered embers and thrown more kindling on them. His face was black. His eyes picked out blue in a sudden blaze as he turned his head and the light struck his face. There was still some struggle going on. No screaming now, but I could hear the grunt and thud of bodies locked in combat. Jamie raised my hands, drew his dirk, and soared through the rope. My hands dropped like lead weights. He stared at me for an instant, as though trying to find words, then shook his head, cupped a hand for an instant to my face, and disappeared back in the direction of the fight. I sank down on the ground, dazed. Hodgepile's body lay nearby, limbs askew. I glanced at it, the picture clear in my mind of a necklace Bree had had as a child, made of linked plastic beads that came apart when you pulled them. Poppet pearls, they were called. I wished vaguely that I didn't remember that. The face was lantern-jawed and hollow-cheeked. He looked surprised, eyes wide open to the flickering light. Something seemed oddly wrong, though, and I squinted, trying to make it out. Then I realized that his head was on backward. It may have been seconds or minutes that I sat there staring at him, arms round my knees and my mind a total blank. Then the sound of soft footsteps made me look up. Archbug came out of the dark, tall and thin and black against the flicker of a growing fire. I saw that he had an axe gripped hard in his left hand. It too was black, and the smell of blood came strong and rich as he leaned near.
"There are some left still alive," he said,
and I felt something cold and hard touch my hand.
Will you have your vengeance now upon them, Ivana Vaishta?
I looked down and found that he was offering me a dirk, hilt first. I had stood up, but couldn't remember rising. I couldn't speak and couldn't move, and yet my fingers curled without my willing them to, my hand rising up to take the knife as I watched it, faintly curious.
Then Jamie's hand came down upon the dirk, snatching it away, and I saw, as from a great distance, that the light fell on his hand, gleaming wet with blood smeared past the wrist. Random drops shone red, dark jewels glowing, caught in the curly hairs of his arm.
"There is an oath upon her,"
he said to Arch, and I realized dimly that he was still speaking in Gaelic, although I understood him clearly.
"She may not kill, save it is for mercy or her life. It is myself who kills for her."
"And I,"
said a tall figure behind him softly.
"Ian."
Arch nodded, understanding, though his face was still in darkness. Someone else was there beside him. Fergus. I knew him at once, but it took a moment's struggle for me to put a name to the streaked pale face and wiry figure.
"Madame," he said,
and his voice was thin with shock.
"Milady."
Then Jamie looked at me and his own face changed, awareness coming back into his eyes. I saw his nostrils flare as he caught the scent of sweat and semen on my clothes.
"Which of them?" he said. "How many?"
He spoke in English now, and his voice was remarkably matter-of-fact, as it might be if he were inquiring as to the number of guests expected for dinner, and I found the simple tone of it steadying. "I don't know," I said. "They... it was dark." He nodded, squeezed my arm hard, and turned.
"Kill them all,"
he said to Fergus, his voice still calm. Fergus's eyes were huge and dark, sunk into his head, burning. He merely nodded and took hold of the hatchet in his belt. The front of his shirt was splashed, and the end of his hook looked dark and sticky. In a distant sort of way, I thought I should say something, but I didn't. I stood up straight with the tree against my back and said nothing at all. Jamie glanced at the dirk he held, as though to ensure that it was in good order. It was not. He wiped the blade on his thigh, ignoring the drying blood that gummed the wooden hilt, and went back to the clearing. I stood quite still. There were more sounds, but I paid no more heed to them than to the rush of wind through the needles overhead. It was a balsam tree, and the breath of it was clean and fresh, falling over me in a wash of fragrant resins, powerful enough to taste on my palate, though little penetrated the clotted membranes of my nose. Beneath the gentle veil of the tree's perfume, I tasted blood and sodden rags, and the stink of my own weary skin. Dawn had broken. Birds sang in the distant wood, and light lay soft as wood ash on the ground. I stood quite still, and thought of nothing but how pleasant it would be to stand neck deep in hot water, to scrub the skin quite away from my flesh, and let the blood run red and clean down my legs, billowing out in soft clouds that would hide me. Chapter 29. Perfectly fine. They'd ridden away then, left them, without burial or word of consecration. In a way, that was more shocking than the killing. Roger had gone with the Reverend to more than one deathbed or scene of accident, helped comfort the bereaved, stood by as the spirit fled and the old man said the words of grace. It was what you did when someone died. Turn toward God and at least acknowledge the fact. And yet, how could you stand over the body of a man you'd killed and look God in the face? He couldn't sit. The tiredness filled him like wet sand, but he couldn't sit. He stood, picked up the poker, but stood with it in hand, staring at the banked fire on his hearth. It was perfect, satin black embers crusted with ash, the red heat smothered just beneath. To touch it would break the embers, make the flame leap up, only to die at once without fuel. A waste of wood to throw more on so late at night. He put the poker down, wandered from one wall to another. An exhausted bee in a bottle, still buzzing, though his wings hung tattered and forlorn. It hadn't troubled Fraser. But then, Fraser had ceased even to think of the bandits, directly they were dead. All his thought had been for Claire, and that was surely understandable. He'd led her through the morning light in that clearing, a blood-soaked Adam, a battered Eve, looking upon the knowledge of good and evil. And then he had wrapped her in his plaid, picked her up, and walked away to his horse. The men had followed, silent, leading the bandits' horses behind their own. An hour later, with the sun warm on their backs, Fraser had turned his horse's head downhill and led them to a stream. He had dismounted, helped Claire down, then vanished with her through the trees. The men had exchanged puzzled looks, though no one spoke. Then old Archbug had swung down from his mule, saying matter-of-factly,
"Well, she'll want to wash then, no?"
A sigh of comprehension went over the group, and the tension lessened at once, dissolving into the small, homely businesses of dismounting, hobbling, girth-checking, spitting, having a piss. Slowly they sought each other, looking for something to say, searching for relief in commonplace. He caught Ian's eye, but they were yet too stiff with each other for this. Ian turned, clapped a hand round Fergus's shoulder, and hugged him, then pushed him away with a small rude joke about his stink. The Frenchman gave him a tiny smile and lifted the darkened hook in salute. Kenny Lindsay and old Archbug were sharing out tobacco, stuffing their pipes in apparent tranquillity. Tom Christie wandered over to them, pale as a ghost, but pipe in hand. Not for the first time, Roger realized the valuable social aspects of smoking. Arch had seen him, though, standing aimless near his horse, and come to talk to him, the old man's voice calm and steadying. He had no real idea what Arch said, let alone what he replied. The simple act of conversation seemed to let him breathe again, and still the tremors that ran over him like breaking waves. Suddenly the old man broke off what he was saying and nodded over Roger's shoulder.
"Go on, lad. He needs you."
Roger had turned to see Jamie standing at the far side of the clearing, half turned away, and leaning on a tree, his head bowed in thought. Had he made some sign to Arch? Then Jamie glanced round and met Roger's eye. Yes, he wanted him. And Roger found himself standing beside Fraser, with no clear memory of having crossed the ground between them. Jamie reached out and squeezed his hand hard, and he held on, squeezing back.
"A word, a chriowen," Jamie said, and let go. "I wouldna speak so now, but there may be no good time later, and there's little time to bide."
He sounded calm, too, but not like Arch. There were broken things in his voice. Roger felt the hairy bite of the rope, hearing it, and cleared his own throat.
"Say then."
Jamie took a deep breath and shrugged a bit, as though his shirt were too tight.
"The bairn. It's no right to ask you, but I must. Would you feel the same for him, and you kent for sure he wasna your own?"
"What?" Roger simply blinked, making no sense whatever of this.
"By... you mean Jem?"
Jamie nodded, eyes intent on Roger's.
"Well, I dinna ken quite,"
Roger said, baffled as to what this was about.
"Why? And why now, of all times?" "Think."
He was thinking, wondering what the hell. Evidently, this thought showed, for Fraser ducked his head in acknowledgement of the need to explain himself further.
I can't... It's no likely, aye, but it's possible. She might be with child by the night's work, do you see?
He did see, with a blow like a fist under the breastbone. Before he could get breath to speak, Fraser went on.
There's a day or two, perhaps, when I might.
He glanced away, and a dull flush showed through the streaks of soot with which he had painted his face.
There could be doubt, aye, as there is for you. But...
He swallowed, that but hanging eloquent. Jamie glanced away involuntarily, and Roger's eyes followed the direction of his gaze. Beyond a screen of bush and red-tinged creeper, there was an eddy pool, and Claire knelt on the far side, naked, studying her reflection. The blood thundered in Roger's ears, and he jerked his eyes away, but the image was seared on his mind. She didn't look human, was the first thing he thought. Her body mottled black with bruises.